Good evening.
And welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. It is my pleasure to be here this evening with Ben Sherwood. This is the place, of course, where you're in the know. You can find us at the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gil Gross from KGO Radio. I'm your moderator for today's program. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Ben Sherwood, journalist and the best-selling author of The Survivors Club, The Secrets and Science That Could Save Your Life. It is my pleasure and honor. Ben is a news colleague, and the timing of your meeting him is one of those providential moments that we've already booked him to be here because it perfectly matches the story that everybody is talking about in the news. In Chile, one by one, miners have been trapped for 2 months and have been emerging throughout the day. As we started this, I think we were down to just one miner left to come up, surviving something that most of us can't imagine. Well, maybe except for the guy who had not one but two wives, he may not survive coming to the surface. But why these people make it when so many don't? Why does one person survive the airplane crash and others do not? We ascribe it to luck, and luck plays into it, but not as much as you think. Prayer, survivors talk of faith. Does faith play a role? Didn't those who die believe as well? And yet faith plays a role. You will find it's not optimism. How about inattentional blindness, the incredulity response, behavioral inaction? These are terms that may sound dull. When Ben puts the life and death stories behind them, you'll find they're not. When you're a journalist, there is the story in front of you, the who, what, when, where, and how, but always haunting you is the why. And there's no bigger question that haunts us when we cover stories than why some live and some die. Is God, as Einstein feared, playing dice with the universe, and are the dice loaded, and is there a way to beat the house? Ben Sherwood is the kind of journalist who asks these questions. Ben has been the executive producer of ABC's Good Morning America, senior producer for the NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw, successful novelist of The Death and Life of Charlie McLeod, which is going to be a major feature film with Zac Efron. But where he's touching lives, and I think even saving them, is through this book, The Survivors Club, which is both a scientific and a personal exploration as to why some people bounce back from extreme adversity, such as 33 miners amazed again to see and feel the sun. They join the select group for which Ben's book is named, the author of The Survivors Club. Please welcome Ben Sherwood.
Thank you very much, Gil. Good evening, everybody. It is exciting to be here in the Commonwealth Club, a great privilege and an honor. Gloria Duffy, who presides over the Commonwealth Club, is a dear family friend, and it is a privilege to be here. I also just want to say that it is wonderful to be introduced by Gil Gross, who said earlier when we were in the other room that at a certain point in his career, he became known as and was introduced when he spoke as the legendary journalist Gil Gross, or that he was known as the veteran journalist Gil Gross. Veteran was the specific word. Legendary is actually in my mind because, and this is not to say that Gil has had more years in journalism than I, but let's just say that Gil Gross is a big reason why I am in journalism. And listening to Gil Gross on the radio, seeing him on television, Gil was one of the, and is one of the great journalists and personalities. And so when I had the privilege of being on his radio show the other day in this area, and also when this Commonwealth Club event was happening, I thought it was very exciting to have the privilege of being with him. And actually, I hope tonight, engaging in sort of conversation with him and with you about some of the topics of survivorship. I also need to mention, as we begin, that it's very special tonight because there are two really important people in this room, in addition to all of you. First, one of my heroes in the realm of survival is in this room. I write about her in the Survivors Club book. She features very prominently. In fact, she's virtually on page one of the book, as it were. And her name is Ellen Clore. Ellen Clore is sitting here. She's not wearing a cape. She does not have a mask. She does not have an S on her chest. There she is. But Ellen Clore is a superhero of survival, and I will tell you about her in the course of this evening, and I hope that she participates in the conversation. She's an amazing person who survived not just a knitting needle through the heart. That's right, a size 13 bamboo knitting needle penetrating her sternum, which was put there by God or by nature to protect your heart from being penetrated by a 13-inch knitting needle. That's why your sternum is there. Heart penetrated by a size 13 knitting needle. And then in the course of surviving that, she discovered, thanks to the CT scans and imaging of her body when they saved her life for that, the doctors called her not long after to say, you've got to come back in because we've found that you have breast cancer. Ellen Clore is a superhero of survival because not only did she survive a knitting needle through the heart, but she then went on to survive breast cancer. And it is her attitude, not that woe is me, knitting needle in the heart, breast cancer, unluckiest person in the world. Ellen will actually tell you that she's the luckiest person in the world because the knitting needle saved her life. A knitting needle through her heart led to early detection of breast cancer, which saved her life. And we can talk about her and some of the qualities that she has that are actually common to survivors around the world. And in fact, I believe they're in all of us. The other hero in the room tonight is an amazing surgeon named Dr. David Spain, and he's right in front of Ellen. David features prominently in my book, too, because I did a lot of my research on survival here. And David and I spent an amazing day at the Stanford Emergency Room in the hospital where David runs the trauma surgery division. David is one of the great emergency doctors in the country, one of the leaders in emergency medicine and surgery, and he helped me understand the survival equation. There is a phrase in emergency medicine called the P sub S, your probability of survival, which when they look back at cases over the course of a year, they can actually do kind of a statistical analysis about who's supposed to live, who's not going to live. And when you actually get rolled into the emergency room, it turns out that the doctors have an actual formula for saying what are your chances of making it. And so there's an actual science to who lives and who dies in the emergency room. And David introduced me to the parts that we understand. And then because he's a very thoughtful human being, he introduced me to the parts that are unquantifiable, X factors, as he called them. The role of faith, the role of luck, the role of the large crowd in the waiting room. Does that large crowd in the waiting room, there rooting for, supporting a patient in the trauma room, does the size of the crowd influence the survival of the patient in the room? David told me that it's hard to quantify. In fact, it's impossible to quantify. But there are an awful lot of times where there's a very, very large crowd in the waiting room supporting someone who's in the trauma room, and somehow they bounce back in ways that maybe the person who's isolated and alone and doesn't have that waiting room support, that person may not recover in the same way. As I plugged my mobile phone into the wall over there before stepping up onto the stage, I saw the CNN bulletin that I think we've all been waiting for 69 days, which is the 33rd miner in Chile has been brought to the surface of the earth, and he's free. Now they have to bring up the 5 rescuers who went down to get them. But the 33 are out. And I think that, as Gil said, it's exciting to be here tonight and talking to you about survival because this story alone, we could spend the next half hour discussing the factors in this survival story. And let me just say that I've spent the last 4 years, 5 years, thinking about almost exclusively who lives, who dies, and why in virtually every situation. In the course of my work, when I was at Good Morning America, I met the 2 Tasmanian miners who were trapped underground for 2 weeks, which at the time seemed like forever, licking rocks for water in order to survive. That was 2 weeks. These guys were down there for 69 days. And if you'll allow me, I just want to talk for a couple minutes before opening up to questions about the Chilean case, because I think it brings in so many of the different factors in survival. The Chilean case is sort of like the World Cup of survival stories, in my opinion. It also is the exception to every single rule. For 17 days, these guys were lost. There was a 600,000-ton cave-in at the mine, and 33 men were missing. So what they started to do was they started to drill holes 1/2 mile down into the ground, hoping to find them. In the Los Angeles Times today, a Chilean official is quoted saying that this is the equivalent of trying to turn on a light switch with a one-mile-long fishing pole. That's how hard it is. So for 17 days, those guys are down there, and according to what we now know, the foreman, the shift foreman, kept discipline in order and ran their time, 17 terrifying days, like a shift. There was a certain amount of food down there, and he rationed the food very carefully. And when they were found on the 17th day, they were down to 2 tins of tuna. That's all they had left. For the next 52 days, this is the wild part, for the next 52 days, it became a completely different survival story. Because it wasn't really about physical survival anymore, although there was the possibility of an earthquake, because it was a very seismic area. There was the possibility of a cave-in. All kinds of terrible things could have still happened. But it wasn't the same kind of isolation that most survival stories involve of this kind. That is, these guys had been found. And then guess what happened? They installed a telephone line so that these guys could talk to their families, to counselors, to media advisors last week who gave them 1 hour a day of media training to be able to handle the 1,000 journalists who were waiting for them above ground. In these tubes, they received Bibles, playing cards, medicine. They rigged it so they could watch live soccer games. One of the guys was a huge soccer player back in the 70s and 80s, and one of the great stars of the Spanish World Cup championship team sent a signed jersey that was dispatched half a mile underground so that that guy could wear it. This is the strangest survivor story ever, if you think about it, because there was one miner down there who was such a fitness addict that he ran 6 miles a day through the underground tunnels to stay in shape. In 1972, a plane crashed in the Andes, the famous Uruguayan story of called Alive in the Pierce, the book Alive, the movie Alive. Those survivors on that frozen glacier at 12,000 feet listened on their broken cockpit radio as the rescue effort was called off after 10 days. They actually sat freezing at 12,000 feet with no food, surrounded by frozen water, but not a drop to drink because it was too cold. They were on a summer vacation trip, rugby trip to Chile. That's where they were heading, so they didn't have any winter clothes. And they listened on the radio as the search was called off. They then spent the next 62 days knowing that no one was coming to get them. Compare that to the miners in Chile who knew from the moment that that drill reached them that help was on its way. Not only was help on its way, if you were feeling depressed, they had medicine that they could send to you. If you were overweight and weren't going to fit into the rescue capsule named Phoenix, they had a plan to help you lose weight in the couple of months it was going to take to get to them so that you could slim down and fit into the 26-inch wide canister that was going to take you to safety. This is the strangest survival story ever. And yet, we all watched riveted yesterday and today as these men emerged from the ground. And I can't tell you the number of people who've reached out to me today to say that they wept last night watching images of these families reunited. They wept at this unbelievable story of success. So how did they do it? So I'm going to spend a couple minutes talking to you about some of my ideas about what it took to get through this. And then I'd love to open up to questions and talk to Gil. We were saying earlier, as I'm a recovering journalist, Gil is technically still a journalist and a radio host. There's no place in the world I would rather be than at the Commonwealth Club tonight. But the second place I would like to be is in Chile, at Camp Hope. Although, to be perfectly honest, when I watched miner number 27 raised to earth today, and I saw the tent where his family has spent the last 60 days waiting for him, there were like 110 journalists in that tent and 3 family members. And the scrum to get those interviews, the people, you need to be a gladiator to get one of these interviews down there. There are so many journalists. So what did it take? The first thing I think that's really important is unit cohesion. This is a military term, very important in survival. That is, in this group, and group dynamics are really important, the unit cohesion, that is, the way that the group operated underground, is very important. Same is true with the Andes survival story. By the way, survivors from the Andes flew to the mine in Chile to offer support. That's how surreal and sort of postmodern and meta this story is, that the survivors from the famous Andes crash came to Chile to lend their support to the miners who were trapped underground. It's completely wild. Unit cohesion, a very important idea. There's a chain of command underground. There's a shift foreman who was in charge the whole time, a guy named Lucho, who was a soccer coach, knew about motivating people. And then there's something called emergent leadership, natural leaders. In any survival situation, 10% of us, experts say, are natural-born leaders. We step up, we're purposeful, we know what to do, we take action, leaders. And underground, there were four or five guys who were not shift commanders, were not managers, were not sort of bosses, who appear to have stepped up and helped organize what was going on underground. 80% of us in disasters around the world, 80% of us respond with stupor, confusion, bewilderment. We don't know what to do. We wait for someone in a position of authority to tell us what to do. Again, this appears to have happened underground, where most of the miners simply did what they were told, waited for instructions, and did as instructed. And then in disasters around the world, there are 10% of us who typically respond negatively, counterproductively, or self-destructively. And again, underground, in the first days after this story began to unfold, the Chilean health minister said that four or five of these guys were really depressed, were really taking it bad, and did not want to participate in one of the videos, and were sort of unconsolable. That's a normal statistic. That's the right number of people in a group of 33 who, when you are trapped for 17 days, fearful that you're going to die in a dark, hot place, it's a normal number that when actually you find out that help is coming, you don't want to participate in a video saying, look, we're all here, check it out, how's it going? It's a natural number of people who don't want to participate. So the distribution of this group makes sense. A couple other factors that I think we can talk about tonight that are very interesting. Faith. What was the first thing that they asked for? They asked for toothbrushes. What was the second thing that they asked for? They asked for Bibles. Toothbrushes and Bibles. Bad breath would be really bad underground. But then you also want to pray, because prayer gives people unbelievable strength in survival situations. And one of the biggest surprises of my research all around the world was the power of faith and religious belief to make a difference in survival situations. I'm not an evangelist, not a proselytizer. I'm not here to argue about the existence of God or God's intervention in the affairs of men and women. But instead, I'm here to say that the belief in God and in a higher power and a plan, the belief in those things makes a difference. It makes weak people stronger. It makes people who are feeling hopeless and helpless, it gives them something to hold on to. And I think that faith played a very important role in this situation. I'd say that the third factor, just sort of to wrap up this part, is luck. And luck is, again, one of these kind of ineffable, mysterious things. But in survival situations, luck is a combination of specific things. I was told by a researcher on the Holocaust that the Hebrew word mazel, luck, is a combination of letters, and that these letters, three different letters, and that one of them refers to the time when something happens, one of the letters refers to the place, and one of them refers to the deed, the time, the place, and the deed. That luck is actually timing, location, and action combined to create luck. And I think in this situation, the time, the place, and the deed meant that these 33 are alive, when in other mining disasters, the 33 are not found. I mean, one last little detail that I found fascinating which was as they drilled down those exploratory holes to try to find these guys, one of the problems was this idea of drift, which is they couldn't actually shoot it in a straight line. As they drilled, the sort of drill would sort of curve off. So the fact that they managed to find that refuge, the fact that they had just happened to have stocked that refuge recently with food and water, that's timing, that's location, and that's action. It sort of seems like luck, but it's not. As David Spain told me, if you choose to have a heart attack at Dunkin' Donuts in the morning when the paramedics are stopping there on their way to the hospital, is that luck? What is that? I'm eager to talk about your questions and to listen to questions and also to engage Ellen and Dr. Spain, who know much more about survival than I do, and also to hear your thoughts about the situation in Chile. I want to just conclude by saying that the Survivors Club book, which I wrote 2 years ago, which was published last year and again in paperback, the most exciting thing about the Survivors Club book is it led to something called the survivorsclub.org, which is actually a website that has just been relaunched in partnership with Hearst. And I urge all of you to visit the survivorsclub.org because it's a place where we have resources and stories for people facing all kinds of adversity, family adversity, health adversity, financial adversity. But what I found was that everybody is surviving something. We've talked tonight about Chile, and I don't believe any of the people in attendance tonight work in a mine and have any likelihood of being trapped for 69 days underground. But everybody in this room is either facing something directly that I consider to be a survival challenge, or they know someone close to them who's in a survival fight. And the wisdom of the Survivors Club is not just about how to survive a plane crash or how to survive in a mine for 69 days. The wisdom of the world's most effective survivors, like Alan Clore, that wisdom applies to every single one of us in everything that we face every day. Because really good survivors are actually really good copers at everyday life. And the skills that they have, the things that they do, are things that we can all do in facing the challenges that we face every day.
Our thanks to Ben Sherwood, best-selling author and award-winning journalist, for his comments this evening. It's now time for the audience question and answer period, and we've got a number of questions. I want to start with just one, because there's a jump here that most people would take for granted, Ben, which is you talked about the importance of faith, and there are real connections between even things such as church and synagogue and mosque attendance and survival. And yet, optimism, which many of us think goes hand in hand with faith, our faith gives us optimism, doesn't work. And in fact, among POWs, right, it was found the optimists were the first ones, right, to break. Why is that?
So there are two really complex ideas that I'm an amateur at explaining, but I'll do my best. And I wrote about them a lot and have thought about them a lot, because the faith stuff. The studies on faith show that people who go to church once a week live 7 years longer than people who don't. People who go to church twice a week live 8 years longer. Now, the reason for that is not, scientists say, because God smiles on churchgoers and frowns on non-churchgoers. Scientists actually don't care about what God's involvement in this is. The scientists are interested in what kind of life churchgoers lead. Churchgoers tend to lead healthier lives. They have a support network around them, and they follow the teachings of the church about a kind of a cleaner life. That's the reason that people live longer when they go to church. And one of the very important reasons is the social network, the support network, the help committee when someone's sick, that people are there to pick you up and that you're not isolated. The science is completely persuasive about how social isolation is very dangerous to your health. People who do not have a network of support and friends are at much greater risk. I will not recite all of the studies, but there is very, very rigorous science that suggests that people who are socially isolated are at much greater risk after having heart attacks, are at much greater risk when they're in the hospital and when they're released from the hospital. Lots and lots of data on that. optimism. I spent an enormous amount of time chasing this concept that you've all heard called the will to live. And Dr. Spain and I talked about it, and I went in search of sort of this mysterious creature called the will to live. And you all probably have said or have heard people say, well, Betty, she's a tough, old fighter. She had a will to live. So does the will to live make a difference in survival situations? Does the will to live actually give people a better chance? Well, it turns out, again, that there's a lot of really interesting science about this. And what they found, particularly in breast cancer studies, which is where a lot of this research has been done, is they found that the will to live in a biological battle, so when you're battling a disease, not when you're facing the Chilean mine collapse, but when you're facing a disease, the will to live, optimism, that will to live, that fighting spirit, does not seem to make an actual statistical difference in lengthening your life. However, the opposite of the will to live, helplessness and hopelessness, the absence of the will to live, can shorten your life. That is, if you feel helpless and hopeless, if you give up, and we all know people who have been very, very ill and who have given up, per se, that giving up can reduce the amount of time. So you have a certain amount of time. The fighting spirit does not give you more time, but the absence of the fighting spirit can shorten your time. What the fighting spirit can do, and optimism can do, is it can significantly change the quality of your life. So that's the core idea that the scientists put forward, for instance, at the American Cancer Society, is that optimism, fighting spirit, positive attitude are not correlated with more quantity, but they are definitely correlated with more quality. So it's quality, not quantity, and it's fighting spirit versus helplessness. Those are the
core One of the things that also showed up, though, with the POWs was, as I remember it from you, is that the optimist sometimes lost heart if conditions went on for a period of time. Oh, they're not coming. But the people just kind of put their heads down and said, I'm going to get through today. Yeah.
So to that point, Gil, the optimists were optimistic until they weren't released from Hanoi at Christmas. The optimists were optimistic until they weren't set free at Thanksgiving, that the Paris talks collapsed. And then what happened was that the optimists rode this roller coaster from hope to total despair. And it was the helplessness, and this is where Jim Stockdale, Admiral Jim Stockdale, the highest-ranking officer in captivity, told Jim Collins, the author of Good to Great, the Stockdale paradox. The paradox was the optimists died first in Vietnam. Why? And Stockdale explained the reason was they would get really, really high, and then they would crash. And it was that crash that they couldn't survive. It was the people who had steady strain. That's the phrase that John McCain used. That's the phrase that a lot of the POWs used, steady strain. You don't go high, you don't go low. You bear your burden with steady strain and you practice realistic optimism. You maintain hope, but you face the blunt facts of your situation. You don't delude yourself, but you remain optimistic that something is going to happen. That's the magic version of optimism, which is realistic optimism.
Questions from the audience. This is a very good one. What is good fear and what is bad fear?
So, what a great question. Who asked that question? Raise your hand if you asked that question. That's such a good question. George asked that question. So, fear is nature's ultimate survival tool. Animals, we have it. It's sort of our personal alarm system, our burglar alarm system built into us. And there's this wonderful little almond-shaped nut in your head called your amygdala, where neuroscientists say that this is sort of the fear center in your brain. Fear is what tells you that there's a snake on the road and you need to steer in the other direction. And they've timed the distance between the sight of the snake going into your eye, into your head, and producing the fear response. And Fear is also what mistakes the snake on the road and sees a stick and thinks it's a snake. And there are two different pathways that scientists have studied. One is sort of the slow road, one is the high road, one is the low road. The high road takes a little bit more time and processes, oh, that's not a stick, that's a snake. The low road goes, whatever that is, I have to run. And what science tells us is that in an evolutionary sense, over the long course of history, our brains have been wonderfully wired for us to start taking action from fear before we even know what it is that we're afraid of. And it's that sort of the speed of that response that is good fear and bad fear. Because here's why. Fear protects us from snakes and sticks. There's very little downside in an evolutionary sense of running away from a stick, right? There's no downside. If you see a stick and you run, you live to see another saber-toothed tiger. If you see a snake and don't run, it could hurt you. So having that instant response saves lives over time. Here's the bad side of fear. Fear is what, when we can't turn off the fear in our minds, if we can't hose down those alarm bells going off in our heads, fear is what then becomes anxiety. Fear is then what becomes post-traumatic stress disorder. Fear is, when it's not controllable, fear becomes incapacitating. And so when they study the most elite fighters in the U.S. military, the elite of the elite, the Delta, the secret guys, the secret operators, they find that these guys possess something called NPY, neuropeptide Y. They possess an abundance of neuropeptide Y. And neuropeptide Y, according to the neuroscientists, is this chemical that basically hoses down the fear alarm in your head and helps you stay on task and engaged and focused on fighting. And so special forces, these operators, have more neuropeptide Y than you and I. So they can stay engaged and on task, and they don't freak out and lose and panic and become incapacitated and unable to respond and unable to act. So this is a long sort of wandering answer about good fear and bad fear, but there's a fear that keeps you alive and there's a fear that incapacitates you. And there's a reason that special forces are really good fighters. They have the capacity to turn off the alarm bells faster than other people. And just one more quick, neat scientific detail. It turns out that neuropeptide Y is connected to your heartbeat. I can't explain the reason. There's a complex explanation. It turns out that having a lot of neuropeptide Y is not necessarily good for your heart. They have very metronomic heartbeats. So the scientists who are studying this in the military at Yale, they say that they can measure a person's heartbeat and the metronomic heartbeat, which is the heartbeats kind of vary, the amount of time between each heartbeat can vary in people. By measuring a person's heartbeat and whether it is metronomic and steady, they can tell who is going to be a successful candidate in special ops school. It's as simple as that. It is incredibly predictive. Because if you have a metronomic heartbeat, you have a lot of neuropeptide Y. If you have a lot of neuropeptide Y, you can control the fear and terror and stay on task and get the job done and be a great special operator. Good fear and bad fear.
Interesting. We have a practical soul in the audience. And those of you who are listening on the radio in other cities can change the city for wherever you live. In a disaster right now in San Francisco, what steps would you take to survive? And I guess, you know, added to that is, what skills would help you survive?
So that's a huge, impossible question, but I will tackle it in one tiny way, which is that California sort of leads the nation in thinking about disasters, and that's a function of 30 years of it being beaten into our heads that the big one is coming. And the citizens of this great city and this great area know very well that the big one can happen. And they know very much what happens when the big one happens. You felt the earth shake. And most people in California, not everybody, but most people in California have done some, not a lot, of disaster preparation. I, in my briefcase, which is not with me right now, which is in the car in a garage a block and a half from now, have a little portable emergency kit, but I'm not ready if something were to happen right now. But all of you should, in your cars, in the places that you work, and in your homes, be ready for something to happen, and you should be ready with about 3 days of supplies. Sort of basic. It's kind of the basic rule. And the most single most important thing that I would impart from my research, and this is having gone through military survival training, Air Force survival training, Navy water survival training, the FAA's airplane crash school, having been genetically tested for the resilience gene, having done all this stuff, the single thing that I would suggest is something that I am very bad at doing myself, which is thinking about what could happen and do I have a plan A and a plan B. Not paranoid, not hysterical, but just what would I do in this situation and in this place if I needed to move very quickly to protect myself and my family. And it's the actual act of thinking about it, being disciplined about thinking about it, not panicking and fearing it, but just thinking about it, that in the phrase of the military is called hugging the monster. It's actually if you embrace the possibility of something bad happening, it becomes less scary to you. And in the event that it does happen, you can actually, after freezing, after being that 80% of us who wait for someone to tell us what to do, you actually can flip the switch to action and say, oh, that's right. I imagine that this might happen. And so I'm ready. So good example is when my wife and I go to the movies, we sit in a dark room with 200 other people, and the lights are out in Southern California, and we're watching and enjoying a movie. When we sit down in our chairs, we make a note of where the primary exit and where the backup exit is. We don't go and test the door. We don't go and follow the road down through the movie theater to make sure that all the doors are open and they're not blocked by popcorn machines. But we make a mental note of where is the primary and the backup exit. And we also, usually on my keychain, I have a little tiny pen light. That's what I'm talking about. That's actually the difference between, in many cases, surviving and not surviving, is having thought about it not once, but twice. Quick little tale from the end of the Survivors Club book. I had been through everything that I've talked about, all that training. I'd written a 300-page book about survival, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning in Los Angeles. My wife and I are asleep. We have a 6-year-old or 4-year-old, I guess, in the next room, and the burglar alarm went off. And I sat up in bed and did everything wrong. I became completely incommunicative with my wife. I used my bionic hearing to detect an intruder somewhere in the house. I froze. Karen was saying to me very calmly, because she is a calm 10% leader type in a crisis. I am definitely in the 80% or the 10%. Karen was saying very calmly, oh, I think that we may have left the kitchen door open and it may have just blown open in the wind. But I couldn't hear that. All I was listening for was for the armed intruder making their way up through the stairs in our home. What I learned an hour later with the Los Angeles Police Department in the front, you know, in front of our house with my underpants, T-shirt, and reporter's notebook, sorry for the image, was what do you do in a situation if your burglar alarm goes off in the middle of the night? You barricade yourself in a safe place with the people you love. You don't go looking for trouble. You make sure that the information with the alarm company, because most alarms are connected to some kind of call center or many are, make sure that that information is up to date. They actually called us in New York City when our alarm went off because we had moved from New York to Los Angeles and we had failed to update the information of the number to call. So they called a non-working number in New York City to make sure that we had not been sort of taken hostage by an armed intruder. Wait for help to come and do not turn off the alarm. You leave the alarm on. You don't shut it down. Survivors are information seekers. Survivors use every opportunity to find new information that might be useful in a tough situation. The fact that you're all here suggests that you're interested in some of these ideas, and some of these ideas may be useful to you if you face something down the road. But I use that example to say that that was something I had not rehearsed in my mind. What would I do if the alarm went off? It had never even occurred to me. We had an alarm, but I never thought of what do you do? So that's the exercise of thinking it through, of what would I do if I faced the situation.
And yet, Ben, As a follow-up, and I wanted to ask something that involved, because we have Ellen Klor here, which is such a remarkable gift to have you not just here, but to have you on the planet at all, with a knitting needle through the heart, which was the way your breast cancer was discovered in time to save your life. So your life saved twice. And yet, Ellen had no reason to expect you to have a knitting needle through the heart, but she survives. Steve Irwin, who dealt with dangerous animals all the time and had every reason to suspect something untoward may happen and he may have to react, is not with us.
But Ellen has a great answer to this question. Ellen, why did you not pull the barb out of your chest when your friends may have suggested to you to pull it out? Your knitting circle...
Actually, come up, Ellen, so the radio audience will be able to hear you on microphone.
Ellen Klor was on her way to knitting circle. She was excited to teach some of her friends some new things. And she fell on it. She tripped on some stairs, fell on her knitting bag, and when she went inside, she was short of breath, and she looked down, and she lifted up her Benetton sweater, and sticking out from her Benetton sweater was the jagged edge, the splinter of the knitting needle that had pierced her sternum and broken off. And someone may have suggested to pull it out. And why didn't you do that?
Well, it was sort of, the joke of it is that I had watched ER so many times and seen, you know, what went on in ER. But the other part of it was that I wasn't that frightened because there was no blood and there was nothing to tell me that this had gone into my heart. And so I just instinctively said, no, don't touch it. And also I have a child, I work with children, and you're used to sort of dealing with little emergencies, and I really didn't think this was a huge emergency, believe it or not. It just didn't seem that bad to me.
And part of, I think, that answer is that Ellen had sort of certain instincts that were a function of experience, life experience. So she had life experience, including watching television shows that were relevant. And I can't tell you the number of times I met survivors like Ellen who said things like, yeah, when my plane crashed into the ocean and I was swimming for my life, true story, swimming for my life, I thought I got to figure out how to go northwest because I know there's land northwest. I don't know how far away it is. But I was in a bar and I was watching and I overheard a conversation of a bunch of sailors who said that Orion's Belt points in the northwest and the east-west direction. And if I can just find Orion's Belt, I can swim in the east-west direction. And so she lay on her back in the water for a minute, found the constellation Orion, and swam in the direction of Orion's Belt. She had picked up a nugget of information in a bar, and that nugget of information had saved her life. Similarly, a pilot whose F-15 crashed in the Atlantic suddenly saw, as he was swimming for his life, saw flashes of green and yellow and immediately thought, oh my gosh, I have brain injury. I'm going to die from brain trauma. And then remembered that he had seen a Discovery show about ocean phosphorescence and that if you disturb the ocean, those creatures that live on the surface of the ocean, when they kind of get jostled, create kind of sparks and light and phosphorescent effect. And he was able to calm himself down that it wasn't actually brain injury that was creating this kind of fireworks, but it was actually krill or plankton or the ocean that was doing that. So it's those little tiny bits of information that suddenly come into play.
By the way, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is best-selling author and journalist Ben Sherwood, who's sharing his thoughts on what it takes to survive and thrive in the face of adversity. As long as we aren't planes crashing, we've got a question from the audience. What do you think of Captain Sully Sullenberger, a local hero, of course, and the lessons we can learn from him? He's the pilot, of course, who amazingly landed his plane in the Hudson River after the bird strike.
So Captain Sullenberger, Flight 1549 crashed 1 week before the publication of the Survivors Club. It was a crazy moment because chapter 3 of this book is about how to survive a plane crash. There's so many things and ideas in that crash and what happened that I think are relevant. Let me just say that Sullenberger, military veteran, glider pilot, safety trainer, he was built for that particular crisis. I mean, literally, if you were to pick the guy to have the engines go out on the plane, he was the guy you wanted in the cockpit because everything he had done had prepared him for that moment, and he engaged in what's known as metacognition, which is he knew that panic, freaking out, he had all those emotions. He describes it in his memoir. He's described it in interviews. He had all the same physiological reaction to the stress of it, but he engaged in sort of this thinking without thinking. He knew the checklist. He went through the checklist. They gave him some bad ideas about where to land. He wasn't going to make it there. He saw a runway on the Hudson. He landed on the Hudson. For him, it was kind of no big deal. The thing that I think is fascinating about the U.S. Air 1549 is that everybody on the plane did what they needed to do. Because for 150 people to respond, to get off the plane, to get onto the wings, to behave in a organized, chaotic fashion, because there was a lot of chaos on the plane. The flight attendant at the back said it was really bad because there was a lot more water at the back than at the front. But the fact that 150 people managed to do the right thing, I mean, there's something in this field called the dislocation of expectation. So you take off, you expect to land in North Carolina, and instead you land on the Hudson. Your expectations have been dislocated. 80% of those people, again, become bewildered and don't know what to do, but everybody managed to do the right thing, and everybody survived. The Chilean mining example is also sort of one of these. I thought of this today, which is that the Chilean mine disaster is sort of like U.S. Air 1549 in slow motion. Instead of it sort of happening, it's a plane crash with a happy ending. The Chilean mine disaster is a mine disaster with a happy ending. One played out over 20 minutes. One played out over 69 days. The denominators are very much the same, in which people, humans, made good decisions and behaved collectively and engaged in what's known in this field as situational altruism. They, in a particular situation, weren't nasty, brutish, and short, as Hobbes says, we all behave in sort of the laws of nature when we're out for ourselves. And instead, they actually help each other. They engage sort of collaboratively in solving a problem.
There are some things you talk about in the book, and as you said, all of Chapter 3 is about surviving a plane crash, which makes surviving not all just a matter of faith, sometimes luck, and all of that. But there are things you have the five-row rule, I think, rule. There's, what was it, plus three, minus eight? Mm-hmm. Can you explain to people what those are?
Sure, Gil. So I was a terrified flyer for years, and in my years in journalism, flying hundreds of thousands of miles every year, I had sort of secret incantations when I got on the plane, and I balanced in a certain way as we flew, and I felt very much involved in the success of each flight. And in fact, my ABC colleagues and my NBC colleagues never wanted to fly with me. In fact, I wanted to fly separately because I was too embarrassed about all the different things that I had to touch in order to make the plane take off and land successfully. I then went to the FAA's airplane crash school in Oklahoma City, and I learned a couple things there to impart. One, the five-row rule. So when they look at plane crash charts of who lives and who dies in survivable plane crashes, sort of fuel-fed fires that are survivable, people within five rows of any exit, not the front, not the back, not the middle, just any exit, within five rows you have a higher chance of getting off the plane. Outside of five rows you can get off the plane. It's possible. It's not impossible. So the travel agent gives you seat 9B, you know, it's not curtains, but five rows, sitting in the emergency exit is best. Sitting closer you are to any emergency exit, the better. Plus three minus eight is the fact that 80% of plane crashes happen in the first 3 minutes and the last 8 minutes of flight. So, you know, most people, if you look around on an airplane, I mean, it's astonishing, but frequent flyers are the worst offenders. Sort of the most experienced flyers are actually the worst flyers because they get on the plane, they put on the blindfold, they've had a couple pops in the bar before they got on the plane, they take off their shoes, they put on their iPod, and they go to sleep immediately, right? So then they rocket down a runway at 500 miles or 200 miles an hour filled with fuel in an aluminum can. And the first 3 minutes and the last 8 minutes are when, in theory, accidents happen, and We know from the literature that 76% of the passengers on serious crashes survive. And we know that 30 to 40% of the passengers who die in crashes shouldn't have died if they'd known what to do. That's from the European study of survivable plane crashes. So what that tells me is you're not going to be in a plane crash anytime soon. Chances are about 1 in 30 million that you'll die on your next flight. But if it were to happen, you want to be able to take action. You want to be able to move. You want to be able to be near an exit. And you don't want to have your shoes off, blindfolded, and listening to music.
There was a bunch of... By the way, where are you sitting on your flight to Los Angeles tonight?
It's Southwest. I get to choose if I get there early enough. And believe me, I will get to the emergency exit or very near it.
I mentioned a bunch of phrases at the beginning. This question from the audience goes right to it. One of the phrases I mentioned was inattentional blindness, things like that. The question from the audience is it good to be oblivious to one's surroundings?
What a great question. I'm writing a new book about animals and about the secrets that the natural world offers us to solving human problems, survival challenges and human problems. And obliviousness to your surroundings is, in nature, a death sentence, right? If you don't see what's coming to eat you, you are finished. In survival terms, obliviousness is very, very bad. Obliviousness is the opposite of what the military calls situational awareness. And situational awareness means that you have a real sense of your surroundings, the threats, and a plan A and a plan B to deal with them. So it's ignorance is bliss, except if you want to stay alive. And if you want to stay alive and if you want to deal with the things that we all face, obliviousness is not going to help you. Now, hypervigilance, panic, hysteria, freaking out all the time about the things, that's not situational awareness, that's overreacting. So there's a healthy place to go, and this is something that I've thought about a lot, Gil, which is that, you know, the Survivors Club book is not a manifesto to panic and freak out about all the things that can happen. It's actually an argument that just a little bit of using this lens that, you know this from your career in journalism, bad things do happen all the time. People who are ready for those things have an advantage over people who are oblivious to them.
There is a moment, though, that you write about in the book when these things happen and things that happen suddenly, crashes, disasters such as brought up in a previous question, there's something called the incredulity response. I mean, sometimes we find ourselves suddenly, unexpectedly in a situation, you know, upside down in a car filling up with water or whatever, and we go through a moment, and in some people tragically more than a moment, where we become a statue, just not believing our surroundings, the time it takes for us to adjust to it and take in what's happening can be literally the difference between life and death.
Right, and that goes back to this idea that we just discussed a while ago, which is that we're all likely to be statues, freeze, immobilized, if something happens suddenly. It's called the normalcy bias in the psychological literature. We're biased toward normal. So if the wing is on fire, most of us look out the window and don't actually see a wing that's on fire because we've never seen that before, and we search our memory for what that thing is that's on fire, and it doesn't make any sense, and we actually engage in behavioral inaction. We don't know what to do. The incredulity response is the same thing. This can't be happening. This is not happening to me. We've all, in bad situations, this isn't happening to me. It's how quickly you can flip from incredulity to action. It's that time that can make a real survival difference. I think that, if I may, in a couple seconds that we have left, I'm interested to ask Dr. Spain, in his experience of so many patients in the emergency room and trauma surgery, do you find that it's the person who hurries to the emergency room, who knows they've got, do those people have an advantage over people who are lackadaisical about injuries and traumas and things? This is David Spain from Stanford. If anything bad happens to you, you've got to hope they bring you to him. You got to hope he's working that night.
Well, unfortunately, for most people who get hurt, they're rarely in control of that. And but I do think there are paramedics, you know, that have that sense. And so there are some that, you know when to drive really fast and know when to drive really, really fast with, you know, the lights and sirens. And so, you know, but there is a element of patient, you know, response in that panic. And, you know, we see it fairly often. And unfortunately, it gets very difficult in some of the patients because there are, you know, some mental illness and other problems involved in that. But clearly, you know, there is a strong element of the patient's attitudes, their expectations, and you know, their, you know, inner strength, I guess, is for lack of a better word.
Doctor, thank you. We have about 8 minutes left. This is a fascinating question. I said at the beginning of this that news people, because we get caught up, as the reporters today are caught up in the story of the Chilean miners as we do this, but we always, days, sometimes weeks, sometimes months later in our business, reflect on stories. So people want to know, and this is one of the questions, how did you become interested in this area of survival?
When I was a kid and went away for the summer when I was 10, one of the rituals was we would go to the local bookstore, and my mom and dad would let me pick a few books to take away with me on our summer trip, summer drive, summer travels. And when I was 10, the book Alive had just been published about, actually I was 12, the Andes plane crash. I have always been interested in stories about people in extreme situations. Just always have. Just love those stories. I've always been interested in the Guinness Book of World Records. People doing unbelievable things. I wrote a novel called The Man Who Ate the 747, which is about a record keeper for the Guinness Book of Records who comes upon a man in Nebraska who's eating an airplane in order to prove his love for a girl in town. But the real reason that I wrote this book is because I needed it in my own life. I'm 46. I have a mother who is a 10-year ovarian cancer survivor. For those of you who know anything about ovarian cancer, 10 years with ovarian cancer is a statistical virtual impossibility or near impossibility. It's pretty amazing. I have friends who are facing life-threatening challenges. And when I was running Good Morning America, it just felt to me like the tsunami in the Indian Ocean had just happened. There had been a massive earthquake in Pakistan. Hurricane Katrina happened. And I just sort of felt like I would like to know what the people that we keep putting on Good Morning America to tell us about their extraordinary survival stories, what do they know that the rest of us should know in order to live our lives? So that's how it happened. Love these topics from the very beginning, love these stories, and wanted the information that these people possess, that Ellen Clore possesses, that David Spain possesses. I wanted information that I can use in my own life and that my friends and family could use too.
One of the things that's fascinating about how you went about this, though, was the fact that there was a science to this, as opposed to when most of us do those interviews, we just want to hear how lucky they were.
Yeah.
And there does turn out to be a science about it.
Well, and that's the thing, right, which is sitting across from David Spain at Stanford, you know, he said P sub S, and I still kind of, I have in my notebook this funny thing that says P sub S. I wrote P sub S, but actually it's P with a little S underneath it, right, which is the, I don't know what you call that, the mathematical way of writing P with a little itty-bitty S, sub S. There is a science to it. David introduced me to the beginnings of emergency room science. Turns out that there's a science to resilience, why some people bounce back and others don't. There's a science to luck. There's a professor in England who has studied the psychology of luck and has done 10 years of studies of why some people are luckier than others. At Duke University, Harold Koenig is sort of the god of the study of faith and health, how belief, religious beliefs, influence health outcomes. in medical situations, in the field of psychoneuroimmunology, the power of the mind to affect your bodies. So these stories, I mean, I had no idea I was getting myself into this. I thought I was just going to go out, interview 20 survivors, write their stories, and that would be a very manageable book. It ended up being this incredibly interesting adventure into the world of all these experts and scientists who are trying to understand what are the human factors in survival. What difference can we make, and what is out of our control?
We've heard Ellen's story and, of course, Dr. Spain's story, the story of the pilot that you told. Can you tell us another kind of first-person story about somebody's survival and what you learned through them? There's so many in the book.
There's so many, and I'm constantly... I mean, the stories keep flowing in through the Survivors Club website, and people share their stories, and every single day there's something new that sort of catches my attention. And, you know, very briefly, one of the stories that I think about sometimes is the story of Edie Eger, who is a Holocaust survivor. She, at the age, I think she was 13 or so, was brought to Auschwitz with her family from Hungary. Her parents, she was separated immediately from her family. And that night, separated from her parents, Dr. Mengele showed up in the barracks. And he was with his guys, and they wanted some entertainment. And they said, who's going to entertain us tonight? And Edie, who had been a ballerina and a dancer, was pushed forward by some people who knew her from her village in Hungary. And while a band played music, Edie danced for her life. And today she lives in La Jolla, California. She's a psychologist, and she helps people survive the challenges of their lives. And she has turned the lessons that she learned from her experience during the Holocaust into a PhD in psychology. And now she counsels suicidal women and other patients on how to deal with adversity. And you can't face the question of who survives and why without trying with humility to grapple with the Holocaust, because every time you tell someone you're writing a book about survival, they say, well, what about the Holocaust? And then you say, I don't know. And then they say, well, go look into it. And then you go spend a year reading about the Holocaust and all the theories about why some people lived and others didn't. And it's incredible the theories that have been put forward. Canadian researchers believe that people with light features, light-featured Jews, light hair, light eyes, had a higher survival rate than others because the Nazis felt a closer kinship with light-featured Jews, and therefore they had a lower, a higher survival rate. There are other theories that the most compassionate and communal survived, that is, the best, the kindest, the most cooperative survived. There's another theory that the most heartless, cruel, and brutal survived. There's a theory for everything under the sun when it comes to explaining who survived the Holocaust. And when I went to see Elie Wiesel, I thought that he would, as an oracle, tell me what theory was right. And he said, every theory is right, and every theory is wrong. And he was right. Because when you're talking about the extermination of 6 million Jews, why did someone die of typhus the day before liberation and somebody else not die of typhus the day before liberation? There could be a typhus theory. There could be a theory about which country you came from. There could be a theory about whether or not you had came from a cold country or a warm country. There are all those theories out there, and they explain a tiny, tiny bit, but not the totality of it. So I wrote a chapter with a tremendous amount of awe and terror about the Holocaust in this book, in which I tried to get at some of the fundamental questions about this unbelievable survival situation. It took 2 years to write the book. It took about a year to write that chapter. Very hard chapter to write.
Unfortunately, we've reached the end of our evening. Our thanks to Ben Sherwood, the best-selling author of The Survivors Club, The Secrets and the Science That Could Save Your Life. We also want to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on radio, television, and the Internet. Remember, history is written by the survivors. So read Ben's book, Survive, Go Write History. I'm Gil Gross, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.